it like a far-fetched lie to the elders of his clan, and of all the clans. A huge flood? They had a flood every year, and simply rode it out on their boats. If Naog's flood actually happened, they'd ride it out too. But Naog knew that they would not. So he began experimenting with logs lashed together, and within a few years had learned how to build a boxy, watertight house on a raft that might withstand the pressures of the flood that only he believed in. Others realized after the normal seasonal floods that his tight, dry wooden box was a superior seed boat, and eventually half of his clan's stored grain and beans ended up in his ark for safekeeping. Other clans also built wooden seed boats, but not to Naog's exacting specifications for strength and watertightness. In the meantime, Naog was ridiculed and threatened because of his constant warnings that the whole land would be covered in water. When the flood came, Naog had a little advance notice. The first torrent to break through the Bab al-Mandab caused the salty sea to rise rapidly, backing up in the canals of the Durku people for several hours before the pressure of the ocean burst through in earnest, sending a wall of water dozens of meters high, scouring the entire width of the Red Sea basin. By the time the flood reached Naog's boat, it was sealed tight, bearing a cargo of seed and food, along with his two wives, their small children, the three slaves that had helped him with the construction of the boat, and the slaves' families. They were tossed unmercifully in the turbulent waves, and the ark was often immersed, but it held, and eventually they came to shore not far from Gibeel, on the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula. They set up farming for a brief time in the El Kar Valley in the shadows of the mountains of Sinai, telling all comers of the flood sent by God to destroy the unworthy Durku people, and how this handful of people alone had been saved because God had shown Naog what he intended to do. Eventually, though, Naog became a wandering herdsman, spreading his story wherever he went. As Kamal had expected, Naog's story, with his anti-urban interpretation, had enormous influence in stopping people from gathering together in large communities that might become cities. There was also a strong element of opposition to human sacrifice in his story, for Naog's own father had been sacrificed to the crocodile god of the Durku people while he was gone on his manhood journey, and Naog believed that the main reason the powerful god of storms and seas had destroyed the Durku was their practice of offering living victims to the large crocodile they penned up to represent their god every year after the flood season. In a way, this linkage between human sacrifice and city building was unfortunate, because when city building was resumed by deliberate heretics rejecting the old wisdom of Naog many generations later, human sacrifice came along as part of the package. In the long run, though, Naog got his way, for even though societies that gave human offerings to their gods felt they were doing something dark and dangerous, and eventually human sacrifice became regarded first as barbaric, then as an unspeakable atrocity throughout the lands touched by the story of Naog. Kamal had found Atlantis. He had found the original of Noah and Utnapishtim and Zusudra. His childhood dream had been fulfilled. He had played the Schliemann role and made the greatest discovery of them all. What remained now seemed to him to be clerical work. He withdrew from the project, but not from Pastwatch. At first he simply dabbled at whatever work he fitfully began. Mostly he concentrated on raising a family. But gradually, as his children grew up, his desultory efforts took shape and became more intense. He had found an even greater project: discovering why civilization arose in the first place. As far as he was concerned, all old world civilizations after Atlantis were dependent on that first civilization. The idea of the city was already with the Egyptians and the Sumerians and the people of the Indus, and even the Chinese, because the story of the Golden Age of Atlantis had spread far and wide. The only civilization that grew up out of nothing, without the Atlantis legend, was in the Americas, where the story of Naog had not reached, except in legends borne by the few seafarers who crossed the barrier oceans. The land bridge to America had been buried in water for 10 generations before the Red Sea Basin was flooded. It took 10,000 years after Atlantis for civilization to arise there, among the Olmecs of the marshy land on the southern shores of the Gulf of Mexico. Kamal's new project was to study the differences between the Olmecs and the Atlanteans, and by seeing what elements they had in common, determining what civilization actually was, why it arose, what it consisted of, how human beings adapted to giving up the tribe and living in the city. He was in his early 30s when he began his origin project. He was almost 40 when word of the Columbus project reached him, and he came to Tagiri to offer her all that he had learned so far. Juba was one of those annoying cities where the locals tried to pretend that they had never heard of Europe. The Nile Rail brought Kamal into a station as modern as anywhere else, but when he came outside, he found himself in a city of grass huts and mud fences, with dirt roads and naked children running around, and the adults scarcely better clothed. If the idea was to make the visitor think he had stepped back in time into primitive Africa, then for a moment it worked. The open houses clearly could not be air-conditioned, and wherever their power station and solar collectors were located, Kamal certainly couldn't see them. And yet he knew they were somewhere, and not far away, just like the water purification system and the satellite dishes. He knew that these naked children went to a clean, modern school and used the latest computer equipment. He knew that the bare-breasted young women and the thong-clad young men went somewhere at night to watch the latest videos, or not watch them, to dance or not dance, to the same new music that was all the rage in Recife, Madras, and Samarang. Above all, he knew that somewhere, probably underground, was one of Passwatch's major installations, housing as it did both the Slavery Project and the Columbus Project. So why pretend? Why make your lives into a perpetual museum of an era when life was nasty, brutish, and short? Kamal loved the past as much as any man or woman now alive, but he had no desire to live in it, and he thought sometimes that it was just a bit sick for these people to reject their own era and raise their kids like primitive tribesmen. He thought of what it might have been like to grow up like a primitive Turk, drinking fermented mare's milk, or worse, horse's blood, while dwelling in a yurt and practicing with a sword until he could cut off a man's head with a single blow from horseback. Who would want to live in such terrible times? Study them, yes, remember the great accomplishments, but not live like those people. The citizens of Juba of 200 years before had got rid of the grass huts and built European-style dwellings as quickly as they could. They knew. The people who had had to live in grass huts had no regrets about leaving them behind. Still, despite the masquerade, there were a few visible concessions to modern life. For instance, as he stood on the portico of the Juba station, a young woman drove up on a small lorry. "Kamal?" she asked. He nodded.
"I'm Diko," she said. "Tagiri's my mom. Toss your bag on and let's go."
He tossed his bag into the small cargo area and then perched beside her on the driving bench. It was fortunate that this sort of lorry, designed for short hauls, couldn't go faster than about 30 kilometers an hour, or he was sure he would have been pitched out in no time, the way this insane young woman rattled headlong over the rutted road.
"Mother keeps saying we should pave these roads," said Diko. "But then somebody always says that hot pavement will blister the children's feet, and so the idea gets dropped."
"They could wear shoes," suggested Kamal. He spoke simple as clearly as he could, but it still wasn't good, what with his jaws getting smacked together as the lorry bumped through rut after rut.
"Oh, well, they'd look pretty silly, stark naked with sneakers on," she giggled.
Kamal refrained from saying that they looked pretty silly now. He would merely be accused of being a cultural imperialist, even though it wasn't his culture he was advocating. These people were apparently happy living as they did. Those who didn't like it no doubt moved to Khartoum or Entebbe or Addis Ababa, which were modern with a vengeance. And it did make a kind of sense for the past-watch people to live in the past even as they watched it.
He wondered vaguely if they used toilet paper or handfuls of grass. To his relief, the grass hovel, where Deco stopped, was only the camouflage for an elevator down into a perfectly modern hotel. She insisted on carrying his bag as she led him to his room. The underground hotel had been dug into the side of a bluff overlooking the Nile, so the rooms all had windows and porches, and there was air conditioning and running water and a computer in the room.
All right? asked Deco.
I was hoping to live in a grass hut and relieve myself in the weeds, said Kamal. She looked crestfallen.
Father said that we ought to give you the full local experience, but Mother said you wouldn't want it.
Your mother was right. I was only joking. This room is excellent.
Your journey was long, said Deco. The ancient ones are eager to talk to you, but unless you prefer otherwise, they'll wait till morning.
Morning is excellent, said Kamal.
They set a time. Kamal called room service and found that he could get standard international fare instead of pureed slug and spicy cow dung or whatever was involved in the local cuisine. The next morning he found himself in the shade of a large tree, sitting in a rocking chair and surrounded by a dozen people who sat or squatted on mats.
I can't possibly be comfortable having the only chair, he said.
I told you he would want a mat, said Hassan.
No, said Kamal. I don't want a mat. I just thought you might be more comfortable.
It's our way, said Tagiri. When we work at our machines, we sit in chairs, but this is not work. This is joy. The great Kamal asked to meet with us. We never dreamed that you would be interested in our projects.
Kamal hated it when he was called the Great Kamal. To him, the Great Kamal was Kemal Ataturk, who recreated the Turkish nation out of the wreckage of the Ottoman Empire centuries before. But he was weary of giving that speech, too, and besides, he thought there might have been just a hint of irony in the way Tagiri said it. Time to end pretenses.
I'm not interested in your projects, said Kamal. However, it seems that you are capturing the attention of a growing number of people outside Past Watch. From what I hear, you are thinking of taking steps with far-reaching consequences, and yet you seem to be basing your decisions on incomplete information.
So you are here to correct us? Said Hassan, reddening.
I'm here to tell you what I know and what I think, said Kamal. I didn't ask you to make this a public gathering. I would just as happily speak to you and Tagiri alone, or, if you prefer, I'll go away and let you proceed in ignorance. I've offered you what I know, and I see no need to pretend that we are equals in those areas. I'm sure that there are many things you know that I don't, but I'm not trying to build a machine to change the past, and therefore there is no urgency about alleviating my ignorance.
Tagiri laughed. It's one of the glories of Past Watch that it's not the smooth-talking bureaucrats who head the major projects. She leaned forward.
Do your worst to us, Kamal. We aren't ashamed to learn that we might be wrong.
Let's start with slavery, said Kamal. After all, that's what you did. I've read some of the soft-hearted, sympathetic biographies and the analytical papers that have emerged from your slavery project, and I get the clear impression that, if you could, you would find the person who thought of slavery and stop him, so that no human being would ever have been bought or sold on this planet. Am I right?
Are you saying that slavery was not an unmitigated evil? Asked Tagiri.
Yes, that's what I'm saying, said Kamal, because you're looking at slavery from the wrong end, from the present, when we've abolished it. But back at the beginning, when it started, doesn't it occur to you that it was infinitely better than what it replaced?
Tagiri's veneer of polite interest was clearly wearing thin.
I've read your remarks about the origin of slavery, but you're not impressed.
Well, it's natural when you make a great discovery to assume that it has wider implications than it actually has, said Tagiri. But there is no reason to think that human bondage originated exclusively with Atlantis as a replacement for human sacrifice.
But I never said that, said Kamal. My opponents said that I said that. But I thought you would have read more carefully.
Hassan spoke up, trying to sound mild and forceful, both at once.
I think that this seems to be getting too personal. Did you come all this way, Kamal, to tell us that we're stupid? You could have done that by mail.
No, said Kamal. I came for Tagiri to tell me that I have a pathological need to think that Atlantis is the cause of everything.
Kamal rose out of his chair, turned around, picked it up, and hurled it away.
Give me a mat. Let me sit down with you and tell you what I know. If you want to reject it afterward, go ahead, but don't waste my time or yours by defending yourselves or attacking me.
Hassan stood up. For a moment, Kamal wondered if he was going to strike him. But then Hassan bent down, picked up his mat from the grass, and held it out to Kamal.
So, said Hassan, talk.
Kamal laid out the mat and sat down. Hassan shared his daughter's mat in the second row.
Slavery, said Kamal. There are many ways that people have been held in bondage. Serfs were bound to the land. Nomad tribes adopted occasional captives or strangers and made them second-class members of the tribe without the freedom to leave. Chivalry originated as a sort of dignified mafia, sometimes even a protection racket, and once you accepted an overlord, you were his to command. In some cultures, deposed kings were kept in captivity, where they had children born in captivity, and grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, who were never harmed, but never allowed to leave. Whole populations have been conquered and forced to work under foreign overlords, paying unpayable tribute to their masters. Raiders and pirates have carried off hostages for ransom. Starving people have bound themselves into service. Prisoners have been forced into involuntary labor. These kinds of bondage have shown up in many human cultures, but none of these is slavery.
By a narrow definition, that's right, said Tagiri.
Slavery is when a human being is made property. When one person is able to buy and sell, not just someone's labor, but his actual body and any children he has. Movable property, generation after generation.
Kamal looked at them, at the coldness still visible in their faces.
I know that you all know this, but what you seem not to realize is that slavery was not inevitable. It was invented at a specific time and place. We know when and where the first person was turned into property. It happened in Atlantis, when a woman had the idea of putting the sacrificial captives to work, and then, when her most valued captive was going to be sacrificed, she paid her tribal elder to remove him permanently from the pool of victims.
Well, that's not exactly the slave block, said Tagiri.
It was the beginning. The practice spread quickly, until it became the main reason for raiding other tribes. The Durku people began buying the captives directly from the raiders, and then they started trading slaves among themselves and finally buying and selling them.
What an achievement, said Tagiri.
It became the foundation of their city, the fact that the slaves were doing the citizens' duty in digging the canals and planting and tending the crops. Slavery was the reason they could afford the leisure time to develop a recognizable civilization. Slavery was so profitable to them that the Durku holy men wasted no time in finding that the dragon god no longer wanted human sacrifices, at least for a while. That meant that all their captives could be made into slaves and put to work. It's no accident that when the Great Flood destroyed the Durku, the practice of slavery didn't die with them. The surrounding cultures had already picked it up because it worked. It was the only way that had yet been found to get the use of the labor of strangers. All the other instances of genuine slavery that we found can be traced back to that Durku woman, Netsnagaya, when she paid to keep a useful captive from being fed to the crocodile. Let's build her a monument, said Tagiri. She was very angry. The concept of buying and selling people was invented only among the Durku, said Kamal. It didn't have to be invented anywhere else, said Tagiri. Just because a Gaffner built the first wheel doesn't mean that someone else wouldn't have built another one later.
On the contrary, we do know that slavery, commerce in human beings, was not discovered in the one place where the Durku had no influence, said Kamal. He paused.
America, said Diko.
America, said Kamal. And in the place where people weren't conceived of as property, what did they have?
Well, there was plenty of bondage in America, said Tagiri.
Of those other kinds, but humans as property, humans with a cash value, it wasn't there. And that's one of the things you love best about your idea of stopping Columbus. Preserve the one place on Earth where slavery never developed, am I right?
That's not the primary reason for looking at Columbus, said Tagiri.
I think you need to look again, said Kamal, because slavery was a direct replacement for human sacrifice. Are you actually telling me that you prefer the torture and murder of captives as the Mayas and the Iroquois and the Aztecs and Caribs practiced it? Do you find that more civilized? After all, those deaths were offered to the gods.
You will never make me believe that there was a one-for-one trade, slavery for human sacrifice.
I don't care whether you believe it, said Kamal. Just admit the possibility. Just admit that there are some things worse than slavery. Just admit that maybe your set of values is as arbitrary as any other culture's values. And to try to revise history in order to make your values triumph in the past as well as the present is pure
cultural imperialism, said Hassan. Kamal, we have this argument ourselves every week or so, and if we were proposing to go back and stop that Durku woman from inventing slavery, your point would be well taken, but we aren't trying to do anything of the kind. Kamal, we aren't sure we want to do anything. We're just trying to find out what's possible.
That's so disingenuous, it's laughable. You've known from the beginning that it was Columbus you were going after. Columbus you were going to stop. And yet you seem to forget that along with the evil that European ascendancy brought to the world, you will also be throwing away the good. Useful medicine, productive agriculture, clean water, cheap power, the industry that gives us the leisure to have this meeting. And don't dare to tell me that all the goods of our modern world would have been invented anyway. Nothing is inevitable. You're throwing away too much.
Tagiri covered her face with her hands.
I know, she said.
Kamal had expected argument. Hadn't she been sniping at him all along? He found himself speechless for a moment. Tagiri took her hands away from her face, but still she looked at her lap. Any change would have a cost. And yet not changing also has a cost. But it's not my decision. We will lay all our arguments before the world.
She lifted her face to look at Kamal.
It's easy for you to be sure that we should not do it, she said. You haven't looked into their faces. You're a scientist.
He had to laugh.
I'm not a scientist, Tagiri. I'm just another one like you, somebody who gets an idea in his head sometimes and can't let it go.
That's right, said Tagiri. I can't let it go. Somehow, when we're through with all our research, if we have a machine that lets us touch the past, then there'll be something we can do that's worth doing. Something that will answer the hunger of an old woman who dreamed...
The prayer, you mean, said Kamal.
Yes, she said defiantly. The prayer. There is something we can do to make things better, somehow.
I see that I am not dealing with science, then.
No, Kamal, you're not, and I've never said so.
She smiled ruefully.
I was shaped, you see. I was given the chance to look at the past as if I were an artist, to see if it could be given a new shape, a better shape. If it can't, then I'll do nothing. But if it can...
Kamal was not expecting such frankness. He had come expecting to find a group of people committed to a course of madness. What he found instead was a commitment, yes, but no course, and therefore no madness.
A better shape,
he said. That really comes down to three questions, doesn't it? First is whether the shape is better or not, a question that's impossible to answer except with the heart, but at least you have the sense not to trust your own desires. And the second question is whether it's technically possible, whether we can devise a way to change the past. That's up to the physicists and mathematicians and engineers.
And the third question? Asked Hassan. Whether you can determine exactly what change or changes must be made in order to get exactly the result you want. I mean, what are you going to do? Send an abortificant back and slip it into Columbus's mother's wine?
No, said Tagiri. We're trying to save lives, not murder a great man.
Besides, said Hassan, as you said, we don't want to stop Columbus if by doing so we'd make the world worse. It's the most impossible part of the whole problem. How can we guess what would have happened without Columbus's discovery of America? That's something that TrueSight 2 still can't show us. What might have happened?
Kamal looked around at the people who had gathered for this meeting, and he realized that he'd been completely wrong about them. These people were even more determined than he was to avoid doing anything foolish.
That's an interesting problem, he said.
It's an impossible one, said Hassan. I don't know how happy this will make you, Kamal, but you gave us our only hope.
Well, how did I do that?
Your analysis of Nag, said Hassan. If there's anyone who was like Columbus in all of history, it was him. He changed history by the sheer force of his will. The only reason his ark was built at all was because of his grim determination. Then, because his boat carried him through the flood, he became a figure of legend. And because his father was a victim of the Durku's brief return to human sacrifice just before the flood, he told everyone who would listen that cities were evil, that human sacrifice was an unforgivable crime, that God had destroyed a world because of their sins.
If only he had told people slavery was evil too, said Deco.
He told them the opposite, said Kamal. He was a living example of how beneficial slavery could be, because he kept with him his whole life the three slaves who built his boat for him, and everyone who came to meet the great Nag saw how his greatness depended on his ownership of these three devoted men.
Turning to Hassan, Kamal added, I don't see how Nag's example inspired you with any kind of hope.
Because one man alone reshaped the world, said Hassan. And you were able to see exactly where he turned onto the path that led to those changes. You found that moment where he stood on the shore of the new channel that was being carved into the Bab al-Mandab, and he looked up at the shelf of the old coastline and realized what was going to happen.
Oh, it was easy to find, said Kamal. He immediately started for home, and to his wife he explained exactly what he had thought of and when he had thought of it.
Yes. Well, it was certainly clearer than anything we found with Columbus, said Hassan. But it gives us the hope that perhaps we can find such a moment. The event, the thought that turned him west. Deco found the moment when he determined on being a great man, but we haven't found the point where he became so unrelentingly monomaniacal about a westward voyage. Yet because of Nag, we still have hope that some day we'll find it.
But I have found it, Father, said Deco.
Everyone turned to her. She seemed flustered.
Or at least I think I have. But it's very strange. I was working on it last night. It's so silly, isn't it? I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if I found it while Kamal was here? And then I did, I think.
No one said anything for a long moment, until Kamal rose to his feet and said,
What are we doing here, then? Show us.
Five. Vision. It was more than Cristoforo could have hoped for, to be included on the Spinola convoy to Flanders. True, it was just the sort of opportunity that he had been preparing for all his life till now, begging his way onto any ship that would carry him until he knew the coast of Liguria better than he knew the lumps in his own mattress. And hadn't he turned his observational trip to Chios into a commercial triumph? Not that he had come back rich, of course, but starting with relatively little, he had traded in mastic until he came home with a hefty purse, and then had wit enough to contribute much of it quite publicly to the church. And he did it in the name of Niccolò Spinola. Spinola sent for him, of course, and Cristoforo was the picture of gratitude. I know you gave me no duties in Chios, my lord, but it was nevertheless you who allowed me to join the voyage, and at no charge. The tiny sums I was able to earn in Chios were not worth offering to you. You give more to your servants when they go to market to buy the day's food for your household. A ludicrous exaggeration, they would both know. But when I gave them to Christ, I couldn't pretend that the money, meager as it was, came from me, when it came entirely from your kindness. Spinola laughed. You're very good at this, he said. Practice a little more so it doesn't sound memorized, and speeches like that will make your fortune, I promise you. Cristoforo thought that meant he had failed, until Spinola invited him to take part in a commercial convoy to Flanders and England. 5 ships, sailing together for safety, and one of them devoted to a cargo that Cristoforo himself was in charge of trading. It was a serious responsibility, a good-sized chunk of the Spinola fortune, but Cristoforo had prepared himself well. What he hadn't done himself, he had watched others do with a close eye to detail. He knew how to supervise the loading of the ship and how to drive a hard bargain without making enemies. He knew how to talk to the captain, how to remain at once aloof and yet affable with the men, how to judge from the wind and the sky and the sea how much progress they would make. Even though he had actually done very little of the work of a sailor, he knew what all the jobs were from watching, and he knew whether the jobs were being done well. When he was young, and they were not yet suspicious that he might get them in trouble, the sailors had let him watch them work. He had even learned to swim, which most sailors never bothered to do, because he had thought as a child that this was one of the requirements of life at sea. By the time the ship set sail, Cristoforo felt himself completely in control. They even called him Signor Colombo. That hadn't happened much before. His father was only rarely called Signor, despite the fact that in recent years Cristoforo's earnings had allowed Domenico Colombo to prosper, moving the weaving shop to larger quarters, and wearing finer clothing, and riding a horse like a gentleman, and buying a few small houses outside the city walls so he could play the landlord. So the title was certainly not one that came readily to one of Cristoforo's birth. On this voyage, however, it was not just the sailors, but also the captain himself who gave Colombo the courtesy title. It was a sign of how far he had come, this basic respect, but not as important a sign as having the trust of the Spinolas. The voyage wasn't easy, even at the outset. The seas weren't rough, but they weren't placid either. Cristoforo noticed with secret enjoyment that he was the only one of the commercial agents who wasn't sick. Instead, he passed the time as he did on all his voyages, poring over the charts with the navigator, or conversing with the captain, pumping them for all the information they knew, for everything they could teach him. Though he knew his destiny lay to the east, he also knew that he would someday have a ship, a fleet, that might need to voyage through every known sea. Liguria, he knew. The voyage to Chios, his first open sea journey, his first that ever lost sight of land, his first that relied on navigation and calculation, had given him a glimpse of eastern seas. And now he would see the west, going through the Straits of Gibraltar, and then veering north, coasting Portugal, crossing the Bay of Biscay, names he had heard of only in sailors' lore and brag. The gentlemen, the other gentlemen, might puke their way across the Mediterranean, but Cristoforo would use every moment preparing himself, until at last he was ready to be the servant in the hands of God who would... He dared not think of it, or God would know the awful presumption the deadly pride that he concealed within his heart. Not that God didn't already know, of course. But at least God also knew that Cristoforo did his best not to let his pride possess him. Thy will, O Lord, not mine, be done. If I am the one to lead thy triumphant armies and navies on a mighty crusade to liberate Constantinople, drive the Muslims from Europe, and once again raise the Christian banner in Jerusalem, then so be it. But if not, I will do any task thou hast in mind for me, great or humble. I will be ready. I am thy true servant. What a hypocrite I am, thought Cristoforo, to pretend that my motives are pure. I laid my purse from Chios into the bishop's own hands, but then used it to advance my cause with Niccolò Spinola, and even then it wasn't the whole purse. I'm wearing a good part of it. A gentleman has to have the right clothes, or people don't call him signor. And much more of it went to father, to buy houses and dress mother like a lady. Hardly the perfect offering of faith. Do I want to become rich and influential in order to serve God? Or do I serve God in hopes that it will make me rich and influential? Such were the doubts that plagued him between his dreams and plans. Most of the time, though, he spent pumping the captain and the navigator, or studying the charts, or staring at the coasts they passed, making his own maps and calculations as if he were the first ever to see this place. "There are plenty of charts of the Andalusian coast," said the navigator. "I know," said Cristoforo, "but I learn more by charting them myself than I ever would by studying them, and I have the charts to check against my own maps." The truth was that the charts were full of errors. Either that or some supernatural power had moved the capes and bays, the beaches and promontories of the Iberian coast, so that now and then there was an inlet that wasn't shown on any chart. "Were these charts made by pirates?" he asked the captain one day. "They seem designed to make sure that a corsair can dodge out to engage us in battle without any warning." The captain laughed. "They are Moorish charts, or so I've heard. And the copyists aren't always perfect. They miss a feature now and then. What do they know, sitting at their tables far from any sea? We follow the charts generally and learn where the mistakes are. If we sailed these coasts all the time, as the Spanish sailors do, then we'd rarely need these charts at all. And they aren't about to issue corrected charts, because they have no wish to help the ships of other nations to sail safely here. Every nation guards its charts. So keep to your map-making, Signor Colombo. Some day your charts may have value to Genova. If this voyage is a success, there'll be others." There was no reason to think it would not be a success, until 2 days after they passed through the Straits of Gibraltar, when a cry went up, "Sails! Corsairs!" Cristoforo rushed to the gunwale, where shortly the sails became visible. The pirates were not Moorish by the look of them, and they had not been daunted by the 5 merchant ships sailing together. Why should they? The pirates had 5 corsairs of their own. "I don't like this," said the captain. "We're evenly matched, aren't we?" asked Cristoforo. "Hardly," said the captain. "We're loaded with cargo, they're not. They know these waters, we don't. And they're used to bloody-handed fighting. What do we have? Sword-bearing gentlemen and sailors who are terrified of battle on the open sea." "Nevertheless," said Cristoforo, "God will fight on the side of just men." The captain gave him a withering look. "I don't know that we're any more righteous than others who've had their throats slit. No, we'll outrun them if we can, or if we can't, we'll make them pay so dear that they'll give up and leave us. What are you good for in a battle?" "Not much," said Cristoforo. It would do no good to promise more than he could deliver. The captain deserved to know whom he could and could not count on. "I carry the sword for the respect of it." "Well, these pirates will respect the blade only if it's well-blooded. Have you an arm for throwing?" "Rocks, as a boy," said Cristoforo. "Good enough for me. If things look bad, then this is our last hope. We'll have pots filled with oil. We set them afire and hurl them onto the pirate ships. They can't very well fight us if their decks are afire. They have to be awfully close then, don't they? As I said, we only use these pots if things look bad. What's to keep the flames from spreading to our own ships if theirs are in flames? The captain looked coldly at him. As I said, we want to make our fleet a worthless conquest for them. He looked again at the corsair's sails, which were well behind them and farther off the coast. They want to pinch us against the shore, he said. If we can make it to Cape St. Vincent, where we can turn north, then we'll lose them. Till then, they'll try to intercept us as we tack outward or run us aground on the shoreward tack. Then let's tack outward now, said Cristoforo. Let's establish ourselves as far from shore as possible. The captain sighed. The wisest course, my friend, but the sailors won't stand for it. They don't like being out of sight of land if there's a fight. Why not? Because they can't swim. Their best hope is to ride some flotsam in if we do badly. But if we don't sail out of sight of shore, how can we do well? This isn't a good time to expect sailors to be rational, said the captain. And one thing's sure, you can't lead sailors where they don't want to go. They wouldn't mutiny. If they thought I was leading them to drown, they'd put this ship to shore and leave the cargo for the pirates. Better than drowning or being sold into slavery. Cristoforo had not realized this. It hadn't come up on any of his voyages before, and the sailors didn't speak of this when they were ashore in Genoa. No, then they were all courage, full of fight. And the idea that the captain couldn't lead wherever he might wish to command... Cristoforo brooded about that idea for days, as the corsairs paced them, squeezing them ever closer to the shore. "French," said the navigator. As soon as he said the word, a sailor near him said, "Coulon." Cristoforo started at the name. In Genoa he had heard enough French, despite the hostility of the Genovese for a nation that had more than once raided their docks and tried to burn the city, to know that Coulon was the French version of his own family's name, Colombo, or in Latin, Columbus. But the sailor who said it was not French, and seemed to have no idea that the name would mean anything to Cristoforo. "Might be Coulon," said the navigator. "Bold as he is, it's more likely to be the devil. But then they say that Coulon is the devil." "And everyone knows the devil is French," said a sailor. They laughed, all who could hear, but there was little real mirth in it. And the captain made a point of showing Cristoforo where the fire pots were, once the ship's boy had filled them. "Make sure you keep fire in your hands," he said to Cristoforo. "That is your blade, Signor Colombo, and they will respect you." Was the pirate Coulon toying with them? Was that why he let them stay just out of reach until Cape St. Vincent was tantalizingly in view? Certainly Coulon had no trouble then closing the gap, cutting them off before they could break to the north, around the Cape, into the open Atlantic. There was no hope of coordinating the defense of the fleet now. Each captain had to find his own way to victory. The captain of Cristoforo's ship realized at once that if he kept his current course, he'd be run aground or boarded almost at once. "Come around," he cried. "Get the wind behind us." It was a bold strategy, but the sailors understood it, and the other ships, seeing what Cristoforo's old whaler was doing, followed suit. They'd have to pass among the corsairs, but if they did it right, they'd end up with the open sea ahead of them, the corsairs behind them, and the wind with them. But Coulon was no fool, and brought his corsairs around in time to throw grappling hooks at the passing Genovese merchantmen. As the pirates pulled the ropes hand over hand, forcing the boats together, Cristoforo could see that the captain had been right. Their own crew would have little hope in a fight. Oh, they'd give such battle as they could, knowing that it was their lives at stake. But there was despair in all their eyes, and they visibly shrank from the bloodshed that was coming. He heard one burly sailor saying to the ship's boy, "Pray that you'll die." It wasn't encouraging, nor was the obvious eagerness on the part of the pirates. Cristoforo reached down, took the match from the cinder pot, touched it to two of the fire pots, and then, holding them tight though they singed his doublet, he stepped atop the forecastle where he could get a clear throw at the nearest corsair. "Captain!" he cried. "Now!" The captain didn't hear him. There was too much shouting at the helm. Never mind. Cristoforo could see that things were desperate, and the closer the corsairs got, the likelier the chance of the flames taking both ships. He threw the pot. His arm was strong, his aim true, or true enough. The pot shattered on the corsair's deck, splashing flames like a spill of bright orange dye across the wood. In moments it was dancing up the sheets to the sails. For the first time, the pirates weren't grinning and hooting. Now they pulled all the more grimly on the grappling lines, and Cristoforo realized that, of course, their only hope, with their own ship afire, was to take the merchant vessel. Turning, he could see that another corsair, also grappling with a Genovese ship, was close enough that he could visit a bit of fire on it, too. His aim was not as good. The pot splashed harmlessly into the sea. But now the ship's boy was lighting the pots and handing them up to him, and Cristoforo managed to put two onto the deck of the farther corsair, and another pair onto the deck of the pirate ship that was preparing to board his own. "Signor Spinola," he said, "forgive me for losing your cargo." But Signor Spinola would not hear his prayers, he knew, and it wasn't a matter of his career as a trader now, it was a matter of saving his life. "Dear God," he said silently, "am I to be your servant or not? I give my life to you if you spare it now. I will free Constantinople. The Hagia Sophia will once again hear the music of the Holy Mass," he murmured. "Only save me alive, dear God."
"This is his moment of decision?" asked Kamal. "No, of course not," said Diko. "I just wanted you to see what I was doing. This scene has been shown 1,000 times, of course. Columbus against Columbus, they called it, since he and the pirate had the same name. But all the recordings were from the days of the Tempoview, right? So we saw his lips move, but in the chaos of battle there was no hope of hearing what he said. He was speaking too softly, his lips moved too slightly, and this bothered no one, because, after all, what does it matter how a man prays in the midst of battle?" "But this does matter, I think," said Hassan. "The Hagia Sophia, the holiest shrine in Constantinople, perhaps the most beautiful Christian place in all the world in these days before the Sistine Chapel. And when Columbus is praying for God to spare his life, what does he vow? An Eastern crusade. I found this several days ago, and it kept me awake night after night. Everyone had always looked for the origin of his westward voyage back farther, on Chios, perhaps, or in Genova. But he has already left Genova now for the last time. He'll never turn back, and he's only a week away from the beginning of his time in Lisbon, when it's clear that he has already turned his eyes irrevocably, resolutely to the west. And yet here, at this moment, he vows to liberate Constantinople." "Unbelievable," said Kamal. "So you see," said Diko, "I knew that whatever it was that turned him to his obsession with the Western voyage, with the Indies, it must have happened between this moment on board this ship, whose sails are already burning, and his arrival in Lisbon a week later." "Excellent," said Hassan. "Fine work, Diko. This narrows it down considerably." "Father," said Diko, "I discovered this days ago. I told you that I found the moment of decision, not that I had found the week." "Then show us," said Tagiri. "I'm afraid to," said Diko.
"And why is that?"
"Because it's impossible. Because as far as I can tell, God speaks to him."
"Show us," said Kamal. "I've always wanted to hear the voice of God."
Everyone laughed. Except Diko. She didn't laugh.
"You're about to," she said.
They stopped laughing.
The pirates were aboard, and along with them came the fire, leaping from sail to sail. It was obvious to all that even if they somehow repulsed the pirates, both ships were doomed. Those sailors who weren't already engaged in bloody-handed combat began throwing kegs and hatch covers into the water, and several managed to get the ship's boat into the water on the side opposite the pirates' ship. Cristoforo saw how the captain disdained to abandon his ship. He was fighting bravely, his sword dancing. And then the sword wasn't there, and through the smoke swirling across the deck, Cristoforo could no longer see him. Sailors were leaping into the sea, striking out for bits of floating debris. Cristoforo caught a glimpse of one sailor pushing another from a hatch cover. He saw another go under the water without having found anything to cling to. The only reason pirates hadn't yet reached Cristoforo himself was that they were making some effort to cut loose the burning masts of the Genovese ship before the fire spread down to the deck. It looked to Cristoforo as though they might succeed, saving themselves and the cargo at the expense of the Genovese. That was intolerable. The Genovese would fail in any case, but Cristoforo could at least make certain that the pirates also failed. Taking two more flaming pots in his hands, he lobbed one out onto the deck of his own ship, and then the second even farther so that the helm was soon engulfed in flames. The pirates cried out in rage, those who weren't screaming in pain or terror, and their eyes soon found Cristoforo and the ship's boy on the forecastle. "I think now's the time for us to leap into the sea," said Cristoforo. "I can't swim," said the ship's boy. "I can," said Cristoforo. But first he pulled up the hatch cover from the forecastle, dragged it to the gunwale, and heaved it over the side. Then, taking the boy by the hand, he jumped into the water, just as the pirates swarmed up from the deck. The boy was right about his inability to swim, and it took Cristoforo considerable effort just to get him up onto the hatch cover. But once the boy was safely atop the floating wood, he calmed down. Cristoforo tried to get part of his own weight onto the tiny raft, but it made it tilt dangerously down into the water, and the boy panicked. So Cristoforo let himself back down into the water. It was 5 leagues to shore, at least, more likely 6. Cristoforo was a strong swimmer, but not that strong. He needed to cling to something to help bear his weight so he could rest in the water from time to time. And if it couldn't be this hatch cover, he would have to leave it and find something else. "Listen, boy," shouted Cristoforo. "The shore is that way," he pointed. Did the boy understand? His eyes were wide, but at least he looked at Cristoforo as he spoke. "Paddle with your hands," said Cristoforo. "That way." But the boy just sat there, terrified. And then he looked away from Cristoforo toward the burning ship. It was too tiring treading water while trying to communicate with this boy. He had saved the boy's life, and now he had to get about the business of saving his own. What he finally found as he swam toward the invisible shore was a floating oar. It wasn't a raft and couldn't lift him entirely out of the water, but by straddling the handle and keeping the blade of the oar flat under his chest and face, he was able to get some respite when his arms grew weary. Soon he left the smoke of the fires behind him, and then the sound of screaming men, though whether he ceased hearing that awful noise because he had swum so far or because all had drowned, he could not guess. He did not look back. He did not see the burning hulks finally slip down under the water. Already the ships were forgotten, and his commercial mission. All he thought of now was moving his arms and legs, struggling through the heaving waters of the Atlantic toward the ever-receding shore. Sometimes Cristoforo was sure that there was a current running away from the shore, that he was caught in it, and would be carried away no matter what he did. He ached. His arms and legs were exhausted and could move no more, and yet he kept them moving, however weakly now, and at last he could see that he was indeed much closer to shore than before. It gave him hope enough to keep going, though the pain in his joints made him feel as though the sea were tearing his limbs off. He could hear the crashing of waves against the shore. He could see scruffy-looking trees on low bluffs, and then a wave broke around him and he could see the beach. He swam farther, then tried to stand. He could not. Instead, he collapsed back into the water. Only now he had lost the oar, and for a moment he went under the water, and it occurred to him that it would be such a foolish thing for him to swim so far, only to drown on the beach because his legs were too weary to hold him. Cristoforo decided not to do anything so foolish as to die here and now, though the idea of giving up and resting did have a momentary appeal. Instead, he pushed against the bottom with his legs, and because the water was, after all, not deep, his head rose above the surface and he breathed again. Half swimming, half walking, he forced his way to shore, and then crept across the wet until he reached dry sand. Nor did he stop then. Some small rational part of his mind told him that he must get above the high tide, marked by the line of dried-up sticks and seaweed many yards beyond him. He crawled, crept, finally dragged himself to that line and beyond it. Then he collapsed into the sand, unconscious at once. It was the high tide that woke him. As several of the highest-reaching waves cast thin rifts of water up to the old high-tide line, tickling his feet and then his thighs. He woke up with a powerful thirst, and when he tried to move, he found that all his muscles were on fire with pain. Had he somehow broken his legs and arms? No, he quickly realized. He had simply drawn from them more work than they had been made to give, and he was paying for it now with pain. Pain, though, was not going to make him stay on the beach to die. He got up onto all fours and crawled ahead until he reached the first tufts of shore grass. Then he looked about for some sign of water he could drink. This close to shore, it was almost too much to hope for. But how could he regain his strength without something to drink? The sun was setting. Soon it would be too dark to see, and while the night would cool him, it might as easily chill him, and weak as he was, it might kill him. "O God," he whispered through parched lips, "water."
Deco stopped the playback. "You all know what happens here, yes?" "A woman from the village of Lagos comes and finds him," said Kamal. "They nurse him back to health, and then he leaves for Lisbon." "We've seen this in the temple view 1,000 times, said Hassan. "Or at least thousands of people have seen it at least once." "That's exactly right," said Deco. "You've seen it in the temple view." She went over to one of the older machines, kept now only for playing back old recordings. She ran the appropriate passage at high speed, looking like a comical, jerky puppet. Columbus peered in one direction and then fell back into the sand for a while, perhaps praying, until he knelt up again and crossed himself and said, "The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit." It was in that posture that the woman of Lagos, Maria Luisa, daughter of Simão Ogordo, to be precise, found him. Also, looking like a marionette in the fast tempo view playback, she ran back to the village for help. "Is this what you've all seen?" she asked. It was. "Obviously nothing happened," she said. "So who would have bothered to come back to look at this with the true sight, too? But that is what I did, and here is what I saw." She returned to the true sight too and resumed the playback. They all watched as Columbus looked about for water, turning his head slowly, obviously exhausted and in pain. But then, to their shock, they heard a soft voice. "Cristoforo Colombo," said the voice. A figure, then two figures, shimmered in the darkening air before Columbus. Now as he peered in that direction, all the watchers could see that he was not looking for water, but rather staring at the image that formed itself in the air. "Cristóbal Colón. Colón. Columbus." The voice went on, calling his name in language after language. It was barely, barely audible, and the image never quite resolved itself into clarity. "So tenuous," murmured Hassan. "The temple view would never have been able to detect this, like smoke or steam, a slight excitation of the air." What are we seeing? Demanded Kamal. Be still and listen, said Tagiri, impatient. What conclusion can you reach before you've seen the data? They fell silent. They watched and listened.
The vision resolved itself into two men, shining with a faint nimbus all around them.